from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Montgomery in today for Mina Kim. Well, 2 weeks after an attempted military coup against Turkish President Recep Erdogan, his government has ordered the closing of more than 130 media outlets and dismissed nearly 1,700 military personnel. President Erdogan has purged tens of thousands of government employees and jailed thousands of people. Human rights groups allege that Erdogan is using efforts to unseat him as a chance to silence and detain his critics. What does this mean for the future of democracy in Turkey, an important member of NATO? And what does it mean for the fight against ISIS? We're going to get the latest from Istanbul, and we're going to be talking to Dayan Nissenbaum. He is the correspondent based in Istanbul for The Wall Street Journal. He's been covering the situation there during and after the coup. And Dayan, welcome to Forum. Are you out there?
I am. Thanks for having me.
First, I just want to ask you, you know, just to get a general situation and a sense of the mood right now, you know, we saw obviously the TV coverage of the tanks on the streets. We've been hearing about possibly mass arrests. What's your sense of the mood right now?
You know, I think that there's still kind of a sense of shock here and a lot of gloom about the fact that the military did in fact try to carry out a coup. That shocked a lot of people that in 2016 the military would actually try and do this. This is the first time in 36 years that the military had actually tried to forcibly remove a Turkish government, a democratically elected government. We are in a state of emergency here that's as long as 3 months. As you mentioned, there's something like 18,000 people that have been detained. That ranges from university professors to journalists to police officers to soldiers to top generals. So I think, well, life looks fairly normal on the streets. You don't have checkpoints around. You don't have a sense of a state of emergency. Feel like it's clamped down. There really is kind of just a sense that the country is headed for more cloudy times.
More cloudy times. How far could that go? I mean, you know, further, deeper authoritarian rule. Further than that, were there possibilities that the president would disband parliament or call for new elections? I mean, how far could this go?
That's what we're all looking to see. That was a question that I asked President Erdogan's aides right after they'd put down the coup, before they declared the state of emergency, if they were thinking about dissolving parliament. And they emphatically said, no, that's not the case, because all of the political parties rallied around the government and stood against the coup in support of democracy as much as in support of the president himself. But as you mentioned earlier, the crackdown against people here seems to be broader than just the people that were involved in the coup. It's against thousands of people that are alleged to be part of this movement run by this Pennsylvania-based Turkish cleric, Fethullah Gulen, who's seen as the mastermind behind the coup. And what we're all trying to see is how broad, how expansive that is going to get. And it's pretty expansive now.
So we hear about these arrests, you know, many people, hundreds, if not thousands of people being arrested. How is that, you know, is that something you're, you know, hearing more about? Are these people being taken away in the middle of the night? Is it more standard, you know, police coming as you know, we would see in sort of a normal situation? And then where are these people being taken?
They're being taken away from their homes. There are reports they've been put in stables. They're being put in the main prisons. They're being, you know, paraded in front of the television cameras every day. Today, some of the journalists that you mentioned that have been arrested were paraded and, you know, in handcuffs, walking out of the jails, you know, flanked by police officers on both sides. The generals have been paraded in front of the cameras where they've been clearly beaten. Amnesty International has reported that some of these people have been, you know, beaten and tortured. So it is quite broad. We've seen arrests and raids in our office, in our neighborhood, with police pulling up. So It's happening quite broadly, I would say.
And what about, I've been reading about other legal measures the government is considering. We've certainly seen in crackdowns in other countries, I'm thinking about Egypt and Russia, where there's a huge clampdown on groups that are getting foreign funding, the NGOs, that kind of thing. I haven't seen that proposed in Turkey. Turkey's a large, pretty wide open country. Could you imagine, though, the government taking those kinds of steps to stamp down on dissent and sort of foreign human rights NGOs?
It's certainly an open question. You know, I think we have not seen sort of foreign entities targeted yet. There is a fairly high level of anti-American sentiment here that's stoked by some of the pro-government Turkish media who believe and accuse the U.S. of not just supporting the coup, but actually instigating the coup, something that the U.S. government has categorically denied. I think if we are going to see foreign entities targeted, it's going to start with any entities that are linked to Fethullah Gulen, and there are various press organizations that do get money or are linked to Fethullah Gulen in some way. So that may be where you'll start to see it move over, and we'll just have to see again, you know, how far it could go and how far it will go.
And again, Fethullah Gulen is the cleric living in a sort of self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania. And the Turkish government has labeled him a terrorist, says he was, or his group was sort of orchestrated the coup. And they've asked the United States to extradite Mr. Gulen. The latest I saw the U.S. was saying they needed more information from the Turkish government. Anything more on that?
They have not presented a formal request for extradition. They've, in fact, you know, made this request for many years. And this, you know, there is a bit of a sense from U.S. officials that they don't really have the legal foundation to get him extradited. You know, when you talk to Turkish people here that support the president, they compare his organization to ISIS, Islamic State, or Osama bin Laden. And, you know, they lump him in the same category, and they are trying to convince the U.S. to see him the exact same way in the wake of the coup. But, you know, it's interesting that the Turkish government hasn't made the formal request, which raises a lot of questions about whether or not they really do have, you know, the legal foundation to secure an extradition.
And what have you been able to figure out about the coup? Watching it on television, it was very strange. I mean, it was obviously incredibly dramatic, and then, you know, all of a sudden we had people in the streets, and the coup was put down very quickly. What do we know about who was behind it, and why they seemingly did such a bad job at it?
Yeah, I think the clearest answer we have today, which is not that clear because we don't have access to, you know, the people that are accused of carrying it out. But what our understanding is that in the week leading up to the coup attempt, the Turkey's intelligence agency went to the military with a list of 600 people that they essentially said were part of this Gulenist organization and needed to essentially be purged from the military. And the supposition is that those people got wind that they had been identified and sort of rushed to carry out this coup, sort of gambling that there would be enough animosity towards President Erdogan that they would flip the country's top general and the top intelligence chief, and they would get people to rally to their side. And, of course, they failed. Both of those people stood with the president. There was a united move, you know, the president's call to get people out in the streets to face the military really turned the tide. That's the narrative that we have now. You know, whether that will hold up to the test of time and history, it's an open question. We don't have a lot of access to, you know, the people to really understand what's going on. U.S. officials say that they do believe that, you know, members of Gulenist sympathizers at the very least were part of this. That's, you know, sort of on background, they say that. They're not officially saying that, so far as I know. But again, it's a little bit of smoke and mirrors, and it's hard for us as journalists to really pin down the whos and whys, especially when the confessions coming out from the generals who say that they were backing Kulin are suspected of being taken under duress, if not torture.
All right, Diane, thank you for joining us, and stay safe over there.
All right, thank you.
That was The Wall Street Journal's Diane Nissenbaum in Istanbul. Now, let me tell you who's joining us for the rest of the hour. Ambren Zaman is a journalist, columnist for Al-Monitor and the Turkish news agency Daikin. She is also a public policy fellow at the Wilson Center and former Turkey correspondent for The Economist. We also have Stephen Cook. Stephen Cook is a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is the author of Ruling But Not Governing: The Military and Political Development in Egypt, Algeria, and Turkey. And Ambren, I want to go to you first. You've reported from Turkey for many years. You yourself have received death threats in the past for your work as a journalist. What are you hearing right now from your friends and colleagues in Turkey, especially Turkish reporters?
Well, I was in Turkey during the coup, so I just only recently came back. And I have to say it was extremely scary, the whole thing. And particularly as a journalist, obviously, and one labeled as a critic, as an enemy of the government, I obviously felt very insecure even as I was trying, you know, leaving the country. I was deeply concerned that I might be detained, as have been many of my colleagues. It's a very, very hard time, even harder time for Turkish journalists, for sure. And as you know, 42 Turkish journalists have been detained in connection with this coup attempt.
And I want to go to Stephen Cook. Stephen, are you sort of seeing the situation similarly, and that is that the President Erdogan is moving towards further consolidation of his power? To what end, we don't know, but that it's definitely a significant crackdown right now.
I think it goes without saying that President Erdogan has used this coup attempt to his political advantage to further institutionalize his own personal power and the power of his Justice and Development Party, which has been a vehicle of his vision to transform Turkish society. So what we're seeing is a more authoritarian Turkey, a Turkey with a more personalized power at the top, and an unstable country all at the same time. So, yes, I do see dark days ahead for Turkey.
And we are discussing the crackdown in Turkey following the failed military coup. Our guests are Ambren Zaman, journalist and columnist, and Stephen Cook, senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Let's talk a little bit about this somewhat mysterious cleric, Fethullah Gulen. As we mentioned earlier, the Turkish government has labeled him a terrorist and says that it is he and his network of people who were behind the coup. Is there anything plausible in that allegation? First to you, Ambren.
Well, first of all of these allegations need to be, supported with credible evidence and, any kind of sort of trial of him and his supporters have to take place, you know, in a fair court of justice. And unfortunately, it's inconceivable at this time that you know, anybody connected to the movement, or Fethullah Gulen himself for that matter, would get that. But having said that, it's perfectly plausible. Indeed, it's almost certain that members of his movement have infiltrated the army, as they've infiltrated the judiciary, the police, and for the time that they were enjoying friendly relations with this government, because, as you know, they were the informal coalition partners of the government in its early days, it was very obvious that they were very much present in the organs of the state and had tremendous influence and didn't shy away from using it, sometimes in very threatening ways, against journalists, for instance. If you were critical of them, it was almost, you know, instant. You'd get a backlash from all their media outlets, and they would carry things as far as to almost, you know, threaten blackmail, because it was obvious that through their connections or their allies inside the security service, they had access to personal information about people. In fact, there's an ongoing court case where it's been revealed that I, among other journalists, were wiretapped by them illegally, for instance. So it is, they're no angels, shall I say.
And so all of this is happening in Turkey, this unrest and this this crackdown. It's happening at a time when the United States and Europe have been pushing President Erdogan and Turkey to step up, help step up the fight against ISIS. What kind of a bind is this putting outside countries in it? In terms of, on the one hand, calling for the Turkish government to be more mindful of human rights, at the same time, really looking to step up things against ISIS, in particular because the group is losing ground, as it loses ground in Iraq. Stephen Cook?
Well, the United States hasn't been so vocal about human rights in Turkey or the current crackdown in Turkey. The State Department has said that it needs evidence and that if the Turkish government goes forward with formal request for extradition, they'll need evidence in keeping with the extradition treaty between the United States and Turkey. This is because the United States wants to maintain its access to Turkish air bases, the main base, the Incirlik air base, in the fight against ISIS. This isn't to suggest that the Turks themselves are as deeply involved in the fight against the Islamic State as the United States would like, but that Washington remains muted because it does not want the Turkish government to take any action that would undermine Washington's access to those runways that are quite close to the area of operations against the Islamic State. But I think that Washington has to live with Turkish ambivalence with regard to the Islamic State. It's true, over the course of the last 6 to 8 months, the Turkish government has rounded up more suspected Islamic State actors within the country and done a better job in terms of securing its border. The government there has been deeply and profoundly ambivalent about taking on the Islamic State head on.
And of course, there's another front here. Ambrin Zaman, of course, there's a long running battle, struggle between Turkey and Kurdish guerrillas. And I want to ask you about that. I mean, Turkey has other interests in the region, in Syria and Iraq, separate from ISIS. How does that add to this whole equation, Ambrin?
Well, it's vastly complicated relations between the United States and Turkey, namely because the United States' top ally in the fight against ISIS on the ground in Syria is the People's Protection Units, which is a Kurdish militia that's very closely linked to another one, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, that's been fighting an insurgency inside Turkey since 1984. And the conflict between the PKK and the Turkish government resumed last summer and is continuing. And, of course, Turkey is calling on the United States to dump the YPG, saying, you know, these people are terrorists, they're all the same. How could you, my NATO ally, be doing business with them? So it's a very complicated situation. But before the coup attempt, there appeared to have been some kind of a modus vivendi struck between Ankara and Washington over this, because, as you know, as we speak, there's an operation ongoing in the Syrian town of Manbij, right across from the Turkish border, which is ISIS stronghold from where a lot of these overseas terrorist attacks were being planned. And the United States, the coalition rather, has launched an operation to take Manbij back from ISIS together with these Kurdish groups and apparently has allayed Turkish concerns that the Kurds would actually remain in that town once it fell. They will be pulled back, the United States has told Turkey, and that they will not be permitted to continue to expand the territory under their control. Whether the United States is actually in a position to legislate that, obviously, remains to be seen. But there seemed to be a sort of de-escalation in tensions over the Kurdish role before the coup. But now, unfortunately, we're seeing a re-escalation with Turkish officials, cabinet ministers, openly accusing the United States of having been involved in this coup. So very rough days ahead.
And we're talking with Amber Nzaman. She's a public policy fellow at the Wilson Center, longtime reporter, journalist covering the Mideast and Turkey. Also with us is Stephen Cook, senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. If you have any questions about the situation in Turkey, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments at forum@kqed.org. Sorry, that's forum@kqed.org. Or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. We do have one question from a listener. Steve asks, will this move Turkey's government in a more or less secular direction? Understanding that President Erdogan created an Islamist party and has been at odds with people in the secular movement in Turkey. Amber and Zaman, when you look into your crystal ball, how does the question of religion play into this?
Well, it played a significant role as the coup was unfolding, because as Erdogan, through FaceTime, you know, he was connected to a Turkish CNN channel.
This is his only way to get to reach the public, right, Amber? And this is when
yes,
he was...
Yes, as the coup was unfolding, he was, you know, invoking a religious, Islamic feelings and slogans, and we had the mosques, you know, basically calling people to jihad. And, you know, the role of Islam seemed to be an important one in getting people to mobilize. So that's something that we all need to think about. And, you know, the idea that, you know, that from the very beginning, the mobilization against the coup was across the boards, I'm not sure that necessarily reflects the truth. I think that Turkish society is deeply divided. I think a lot of people are very scared. As for whether Turkey will be headed in a more secular or less secular direction, I think the notion that Turkey was secular to start with is somewhat misguided, because as things stand, religion, Islam in Turkey is very much legislated by the state. There's this sort of government institution called the Religious Affairs Directorate that appoints all the country's imams, that writes up their sermons. So the idea that the church and state, or the mosque and state, is separate in Turkey is a misguided one.
And I want to ask a different question. Stephen Cook, President Erdogan began his political career when he was elected mayor of Istanbul. He has accomplished many things, both as mayor. He cleaned up the city, got services working, went into national politics, really put Turkey on the map again as a regional or global player, had some economic successes, and then things started taking a turn. What's the simplest way you could describe what happened to President Erdogan and set him in this more sort of authoritarian direction?
Well, it's a relatively long and complicated story.
Right.
Unfortunately, we don't have enough time, but I think it's important for your listeners to understand two things. One, after this period early on in his rule, let's say between 2003 and 2007, Erdogan became concerned that the establishment, the Turkish establishment, the people that he refers to as white Turks, would never actually accept him or his party, this religiously tinged organization that had been so successful. And there was concern that the military and others were plotting against them. And it was actually a story that was manufactured, but nevertheless, he used this to great effect. And from that point on, let's say 2007, 2008, and in 2008, there was a case within the Turkish Constitutional Court that sought to close the party for being a center for anti-secular activity. Now, the court voted that the party was, in fact, a center of anti-secular activity, but didn't have enough votes to actually close it. From that point on, Erdogan's magnanimity towards his opponents disappeared, and he determined that no one could contest the political the political system, that there could be more people brought into the political system, but contesting it by questioning the direction that the Justice and Development Party and that Tayyip Erdogan were taking the country was off limits. And that's when you started to see wide-scale use of authoritarian measures to intimidate and coerce opponents of the Justice and Development Party and Erdogan himself.
Yeah, I want to take a call. We have David in Miami, Florida. David has a question about Cleric Gulen. David, go ahead.
Hi. I'll take my answer off the phone, but we've got a cleric who's in exile, self-imposed, I believe, in Pennsylvania. I mean, our government must have been monitoring, of all the people that were monitoring, he had to be on the list of somebody monitoring what he was doing. And if he was, we have to know what his status was. And if he was trying to do something, we are complicit in supporting him. If he wasn't trying to do something, then we should know that too. And we're playing some sort of a political or public game. Well, Turkey has to present evidence. We should have the evidence.
Right, David. Thanks for your question. So the question is, if the United States was tracking this cleric, Mr. Gulen, they might very well have evidence to support the Turkish government's allegations that he was involved in this coup. And to either one of you, we just have about a minute and a half left. Stephen Cook, briefly, what's your thought on that?
Well, my thought is that it's entirely possible that the United States is aware of it. But to extradite Gulen is to almost certainly send him to either life imprisonment or possibly even death. So that if the Turkish government wants him, by dint of the extradition treaty that we have with them, they need to file the papers and present the evidence. It's not incumbent necessarily on the United States to hand him over, especially when, look, American officials say we're perfectly willing to consider the extradition request. We don't have the evidence to send him on a plane back to Turkey.
All right. Well, thank you. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us. We were joined by Dayan Nizenbaum of The Wall Street Journal, Amran Zaman, journalist and columnist at Al Monitor and online Turkish news site Daikin, and Stephen Cook, senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for joining us. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lowerberg, and Jeremy Siegel. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupi, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schroeder-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Montgomery, in today for Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.